as soon as that shooter is in place, we just send two Mews from that Hoochie Mama, just like, and it's real, like, it's pop, pop. It's very, like, consecutive. So anytime we use a calling device, it's very clear that it's not an actual elk.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Guys, thank you for tuning in this week. Before we drop into the show, wanted to give a shout out to Justin Garcia for leaving us a review in iTunes. And Justin, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry swag. So email us your shipping address to podcast@exomountaingear.com. And listeners, if you want to enter into these giveaways, it's simple. We just want to hear from you. Your feedback, comments, suggestions. You can leave us a review in iTunes, Google Podcast, Stitcher, or wherever else you're listening to this. Or contact us directly by email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. On this week's show, we have Jake Sines, who is a coach from Atomic Athlete. We've talked with him before about fitness, but today's episode is all about elk hunting, and specifically what he has learned hunting public land bulls over the last several years. This is a super interesting topic. Jake wrote an article for us that was titled, 8 Elk Hunting Lessons I've Learned the Hard Way. And once we got that article, we knew we just had to discuss this further, more in depth. So we go into detail about some of the things that he's learned, which he has a different perspective than a lot of the hunting writers or podcasters and guys out there. He's just a regular guy who has truly learned some lessons the hard way. Some of the great takeaways from this are the content we cover on nonverbal communication, how him and his hunting partners have developed a system to communicate with each other, kind of between shooter and caller, in hunting situations. So if you're one of those guys that hunts with somebody specifically for elk, and you've been in those situations where you got the caller and the shooter, and the caller's back wondering what's going on up with the shooter and vice versa, and that whole confusion, consider developing your own system as Jake outlines in this show. But there's more than that. So tune in. It's a great, great, great episode. If you head over to our website, you can also read the article that was the basis for today's discussion if you want to learn more as well. Don't forget, guys, before we dive into this one, if you're listening to this as it comes out in August of 2018, right now we're running the End My Exo giveaway. If you want to learn more about how you can win prizes from Katabatic Gear, First Light, Benchmade, and many others, go to exomountaingear.com/endmyexo. All right, here's this episode with Coach Jake Sines from Atomic Athlete discussing elk hunting lessons he has learned the hard way. Jake, welcome back to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you back on. We talked training quite a bit the first time, and this one we're going to really dive into some of your experiences elk hunting. This show is derived from an article you wrote for us, 8 Elk Hunting Lessons Learned the Hard Way. So excited to dive into that. Before we do, I know we, some listeners might have caught you in a previous episode. I believe it was 105, where again, we talked physical training, but I don't know that we talked much about your hunting experience and background there. So go ahead and give us the 2-second overview of who you are personally, professionally, but then kind of your elk hunting background a little bit to give us context.
Cool. This is actually exciting because it's the first time I've been on a podcast that I'm not talking about exercise. So
something different. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm much more qualified to talk about exercise than hunting, but, long short of it, was always, really into being outdoors. After high school, went in the military, spent 4 years over in the Ranger battalions, got out and did the college thing. And I started, coaching and training, I guess, professionally about 2008, 2009, I started Atomic Athlete, and that's a not only a local training facility a big 15,000 square foot warehouse with, you know, hundreds of athletes, but also an online platform that kind of goes along with that to, and it's a little different than online platform. It's more, I guess, more kind of geared at specific training than just kind of like general gym time training, where it's like, you know, more of a garage gym setting. There's culture. You're there because the people around you, you know, motivate you to work harder. The online platform is a little more designed for people who are like, hey, I'm probably going to be doing this solo, and I have the discipline to kind of follow through and do that specific program. But I guess got into hunting kind of when I was in the military, just like went out with a rifle and, you know, shot a couple whitetail on base, and then had been in the mountains and never really had a chance to be exposed to it. And I went on an elk hunt in near Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I shot a cow. And that was kind of like, it was just, man, it was, that's a whole story in itself, but it was a long, rough, and pretty exciting day. And then so I went again the next year in Colorado, an over-the-counter rifle unit, and really had no clue what I was doing. The first time I was with a guy who was a local, and he kind of had a pretty good idea where the elk were at. Second time went out, basically was just hiking with a rifle, had no clue what I was doing. And then I guess about 4 years ago, I got into archery elk with another guy who ended up becoming a really, really close personal friend of mine, and have been totally hooked on that. So we're pretty much always wilderness archery elk hunting now, and it's usually for pretty long durations. So we go out, first year was, I think I shot my elk on the 27th day of hunting, and these past couple years have been about 16 day hunts where we go in, you know, backcountry, set up a base camp 6-7 miles back, and we just stay out there until the elk drop.
Dude, that's awesome. I mean, how much of a factor do you think that time in the field is to success? Because, I mean, here in 20 plus days or 16 days, you know, so many folks listen to this. Heck, myself, most of my hunts have been like, I have 7 days max, you know, and a lot has to go right to make that happen in those random 7 days that you get to fit on your calendar. So with 20 something days, I'm sure that extends your opportunity and therefore helps with success, right?
Definitely, definitely. And it's, I think it's just one of those things where, like, the more time you go, I mean, you hear some of the guys like, you know, like Aaron Schneider, and they spend like 200 days in the field. I mean, you just can't read enough books or articles or listen to enough podcasts to get that experience. I mean, just this, every encounter, every morning, trails, rubs, sign, just getting the feel of the land. I think that's that is the biggest challenge. But then again, that's the purpose of like podcasts and articles, is that, I mean, getting 2 weeks off is pretty much impossible for most people. Luckily, I own a gym, and so I have, you know, coaches that work for me, and I kind of schedule my year around like doing favors. And then when I take off, I'm able to leave for up to a month at a time. But the more time you can spend out there, the better, which kind of tied into one of the things I wrote about the article, which was like hunting all day.
Yeah, let's dive into this. So we have 8 elk hunting lessons learned the hard way. You know, you talk about how you've done pretty much 6 years of elk hunting. For those years, you've been successful. That's a, you know, obviously, regardless of how much your time you're spending in the field, 4 out of 6 is freaking fantastic for just, you know, on your own and over the counter tags and, you know, pretty much public land opportunities. So that's awesome. So let's just dive into the first one you talked about, and this is just great stuff that, you know, we just don't see talked about a lot or talked about in these ways. So I'm excited to have your perspective. But the first one is be able to use nonverbal communication. So this is clearly from perspective of hunting with a partner, you know, not solo. But how has this played out? What are some of the lessons you've learned? And then from that, I'd love to begin to work through how you and your buddies begun to develop a system for nonverbal communication.
Yeah, that was something that, you know, I think initially when I started hunting with a partner, you know, because whenever we hunt, we usually walk slightly spread out. So in case we have to drop into a setup, like, we're already there. And this is obviously like, you know, moving through the timber. You know, we're not up on a ridge glassing or anything. We're moving through timber. We're either moving on an animal or we're just sifting, basically, because no animals are being vocal. And a lot of times, like, I would, you know, see something and he would be 25 to 45 yards back behind me, and he couldn't have the same perspective that I had, you know, and as anyone knows who moves through heavy timber, it's like, it's pretty loud. So at that point, we've gotten to a location where we, you know, have not alerted the animals yet. And So I just think back, and I think it was Predator when like Arnold like threw his fist up in the air, you know, and like flexed. And so like because I would just do that and I would like freeze. And I'm super excited, you know, because this is my first year archery elk hunting and it was like so close. And then he would kind of look at me and I would just kind of stand there and look at him. And like, there was a lot that needed to be said that we just couldn't say. I couldn't be like, Hey, you know, and, cause at that point, I mean, we're like danger close. I mean, I can see the animal could see me if I moved or if I, you know, made noise. And so kind of as that hunt progressed, we started kind of coming up with a system where I could like tell him exactly, what I was seeing. And so, you know, we started coming up with these different hand signals for like, whether it was, a deer, like a coyote or a fox, elk, the gender, you know, so I would like touch my head in a different way for like a cow versus a bull. Cause depending on when the hunt was or what phase the hunt would determine whether or not we were going to take a cow, or wait for a bull. So if it's like day one, day two, you know, we're like, hey, we'll pass on those cows. But if it's like day 14 and we got like, we're on the last day, it's like, hey, we're going to, you know, put a cow down. So not only letting them know like what the animal was, its gender, but like where it's at and how far it is. So it like, it ends up being like a little kind of sign language, sequence that now both of us, we very clearly understand. And we usually refresh it every year because we find ourselves in the situation where we hadn't considered before, which one of them, for example, was the bugles back and forth, which I talked about this year. But it's made our lives tremendously easier when we're not like arm's distance of one another.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, things of, obviously hand signals can be, you know, pretty easy, right? Like you can throw up numbers, but I'm curious how you guys, for example, don't confuse numbers. So like, say you're seeing a number of elk versus signaling a distance of elk. Those are both numbers. So you can just start flashing like 4 or 5 or whatever, but how do you distinguish between say the number of elk versus the distance, for example?
Well, we usually, at least the sequence that I always use is like, I'll point to myself, like I point to my eye, see, and then I'll give a quantity. And so it'll be like 3, elk. And so if it's two different genders, I'll say, I see 2, and then I'll make the symbol for a bull. And then I'll say 3 and make the symbol for a cow. So as I see 2 bulls, 3 cows, and I will point to the direction and then I will signal the yards. And typically the distance is going to be 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. It's probably not going to be above 100. There's not many places where we can see further than 100 yards where we hunt, unless we're like up in a big meadow or a big basin or something like that. So it's pretty much always follows that sequence. And then we kind of follow up with either like sit or I'll direct him to set up a setup somewhere, depending on what the wind's doing. So then we usually have like a follow-up course of action. You know, if it's just a couple of cows and it's like day 3, then we may just settle and just watch. Cause a bull might be in the vicinity and we just don't know where he's at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. You guys would be the freaking masters of like a hunting charades tournament, I'm sure.
it gets better every year. At first it was super basic. But then we'll get in ourselves where I'm looking at him like he's like, I'm like, ah, the guy's an idiot. He's looking at me like hands up in the air and we're trying to communicate with each other, but we can't. And then, so we get back, we'll be frustrated, like, okay, new symbol, you know, and we'll go through and talk through like a new kind of addition to the sequences.
How do you guys play that out? Not in terms of the communication aspect, but just in terms of like shooter caller partnerships. Do you guys like trade days? Like today you're the shooter, today you're the caller. And then if someone is the designated shooter, are they the one like calling all the shots in terms of where to go, what call setups to do, like when to bugle, when to cow call? How does that play out with you guys?
Yeah. Well, the good thing, me and my partner are neither one of us are even the tiniest bit selfish. Like we're super, like we have a team mindset. So like if I shoot an animal and my partner called it in, like he takes just as much pride as in calling that animal in as opposed to shooting it. So he's like, we're both on the same page where it's not like, oh, he got one, I didn't, or man, I really wish I was up front. So we really have a team mindset on that because we split everything. We split costs, we split meat. The only thing we don't split is the antlers if you shoot a bull. So for us, it's totally a team effort and both of us are totally okay coming back with one animal and we could care less who shot it. You know, if we keep that mindset moving forward, then we'll both get plenty of opportunities. And we usually just kind of rotate maybe a situation by situation. We're both always carrying our bows. So it's not like, hey, I'm going to leave my bow at camp, I'm just the caller today. It's going to be usually kind of situation dependent, where we're moving, it's like, hey, go for it. And both of us typically are like, hey, go ahead. We usually want the other guy to go first. Mm. And I guess earlier on, I was usually always kind of following him, like playing. He was playing league because he was more experienced. He's been doing it like, I think, 8 years. And I was always kind of more the passive partner. But as we've kind of hunted together and I've developed my skills, now we're kind of a little more of a 50-50 partnership. So we'll take turns like, hey, where do you want to hunt this morning? We'll say why we want to hunt there. We'll throw our 2 cents back and forth at each other. And then we usually just like, hey, cool. It's your call. It's your hunt. Let's do it. Yeah. And there's not too much kind of like, well, I don't think we should do that. You know, it's kind of like, okay, cool.
Yeah. That's awesome.
A good hunting partner is hard to find.
It is. I mean, everything you said is the way it is with, me and the guy I've been hunting elk with for several years now. And it's like you said, it's just truly a team. It doesn't matter who shot it or what. Like the first time we hunted together, I was able to call in a bull that he shot it, you know, just basically steps away. And I was genuinely, truly just as excited of how that went down as if I, you know, let that arrow go. Like it truly didn't even matter. It's just like when you're working as a team, and especially in situations where the caller is truly effective, right? Like you played a huge freaking role in making that happen. And it's just so much fun.
Well, I would almost argue a bigger role. I mean, because like you're the one who's like, I mean, you didn't pull the bow back and take the shot. But I mean, if you're shooting an elk at 20 yards, you know, it's not exactly a high skill thing. You could probably teach someone how to do that in 30 minutes, you know. But it's like, how do you move through the wilderness, find an area, like locate an animal, set up, and then call them in? Like that is the hunting, right? And if you just eliminate the small moment of pulling the trigger and killing the animal, it's like all the other things leading up to it is, I think, more of the hunt than just, you know, drawing back and taking a shot.
So continuing on nonverbal communication, we talked about the hand signals. That's kind of when you guys are moving through timber and maybe spot something. But then you guys have some communication calls during a calling setup. So you got shooter head, you got caller back. Oftentimes, I know from experience, you can't see each other. Sometimes the caller's back, he can't see the shooter or the elk. He doesn't know what's going on. Like, is the bull coming? Is he hung up? Do we need to move? Do we stay?
Yeah,
do I need to shut up? Like,
45 minutes in, you're still back there raking stuff and making all this noise, and you're annoyed. And we started using the Hoochie Mama, which is just that, for guys who don't know, it's just kind of like a little squeaky toy, I guess is the best way I can put it. We don't usually use those that much to actually call in our calling sequences. We use like external reeds and diaphragms, and I get this really cool little box thing last year, and I can't remember who made it, but it works really well. So we don't really use that, but we can tell the sound immediately. Like if, you know, we're hearing something and we hear a Hoochie Mama, it's a very like definitive sound. And so that's kind of like, we both have those in our pockets, our cargo pockets. And that's like, that's our tool to communicate back and forth in a setup. And because, I mean, like I said, a lot of times you'll be back there and you're just like, in like an hour into a calling sequence, I go, is there any elk even in this area? You know, and you can't see what he can see up front. You know, he's anywhere from 30 to 50 yards up front. And you're just kind of tucked behind this like shrub and this like little pile of like debris, and you're making all this noise, and you're just kind of like, oh, I hope something's happening up there.
So what are some of the specific instructions basically, and then how do you send those with the Hoochie Mama?
So typically, you know, we kind of have this like little powwow, and this is assuming we're moving on an active bull. You know, so we use the same thing that Corey Jacobson teaches, you know, the arc. Using the wind, playing on it, coming around, trying to get downwind. So we'll get the caller set up, and then he's like, hey, I'm going to go move this way. And so as soon as that shooter is in place, we just send 2 mews from that Hoochie Mama, just like, and it's real, like it's pop, pop. It's very like consecutive. So anytime we use a calling device, it's very clear that it's not an actual elk, you know? So we send 2, and that means go for it. As the call-in sequence is going, basically either the shooter or the caller can decide to, you know, call the sequence, stop it. And typically it'll be from up front. So up front, you know, we'll send up 2 more, and that means like, hey, the animal's gone, or they've moved, or like, let's stop this call-in sequence and set up. If the person who's calling sends 2, it's more of a question. It's like, hey, do you still want me to call? You know, like, ew, ew. And the shooter that makes the decision, because there may still be animals in the area. A lot of times we haven't had animals come in hot. We would have animals just kind of like hear that sound and they'd be like, oh, there's other elk over there. So I feel safe right now. And they'll end up just kind of sifting into a lane and allowing us to take a shot versus like coming in actively like a hot bull would. So at that point, you know, the caller is basically asking a question like, can I stop? And then the shooter will either say, yes, stop, by replying with two more. Or if there's total silence, that means there's still elk in the area, continue to call. Another situation would be the shooter is up front and the elk move. They're not moving as in spooked, but they're just kind of sifting away. And typically in that condition or in a setup like that, the wind is going to be in our favor. And elk are kind of noisy animals, so we're not really afraid to try to sneak up on them as they're feeding. And so what will happen sometimes is that shooter will just decide, he's like, hey, I'm going to move on them and potentially, you know, get in a lane where I can take a shot. And so we'll send back three mews and just be like, hey, I'm moving. And actually, this mix up. That is come to me. So typically we may leapfrog is what we're doing. So I want to move forward, but I want my caller to move forward as well. So three mews, he'll come to me and then I'll leapfrog forward. And the final one, which I was just talking about, is like, hey, I'm moving forward. You just keep calling. Is we'll just send out like a little tiny spike squeal. Because typically a little spike squeal is not going to bring in a bull. It's once again, he hears it, he acknowledges it, but he's not going to come in because we don't want them to focus too much on that shooter, especially if he's going to move. So those have helped out a lot because a lot of times we'll be spread out and neither one of us initially could. We just didn't know what was happening. And sometimes like I would see an opportunity to move forward. And like an elk would go around like, you know, a thicket. And I was like, hey, I can probably move forward really fast and get in a better position. And so I would do so a couple of times. And the next thing you know, my partner has no clue where I'm at.
Man, that's so good. The key is not that the two mews is magic or whatever. The key is to come up with a system between you and your partner or whatever that is. Think of the scenarios that you want to be able to communicate and then figure out, you know, a cheat sheet, you know, and a protocol to do that. So obviously yeah. What you guys are doing with the Hoochie Mama works for you guys. And I think it is a great way to do it because the Hoochie Mama does sound pretty distinct, you know, especially from most guys making mouth calls with diaphragms or reeds. And then the other nice thing about the Hoochie Mama is just it's there, it's quick, it's convenient. Yeah, that's awesome. That's such a great idea.
Yeah. And I think you don't have to like sit down before the hunt and plan all this stuff, but just like when, you know, maybe come up with your own situation. Like these are the things that seem to happen regularly with me and my partner. And then like, it can be in the field on the spot. Cause that's how most of these were just kind of come up. You know, they would evolve from like right then, hey, that was kind of frustrating. Like, how about this? Like, how about from now on we do A and B? And yeah. Then like, boom, right there, you just kind of set like what the military calls an SOP, like a standard right. operating procedure. And so you don't have to plan it in advance. Just kind of think about that as you go into your hunt, you experience something that's kind of frustrating and you, hey, there's a potential problem here. Let's come up with a solution.
Yeah. And I think even if you did plan it in advance, it'd be good to go over that. Like, okay, remember two of these and then we're going to do this type thing right before the encounter. Because obviously yeah. you could talk about weeks in advance and then totally blank.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, a reminder and like the next one we're going to talk about, I mean, the story is, it's hilarious, because, which is basically talking about longer distances. And we learned a couple of really good lessons over long distance.
Yeah. Let's dive into it.
And the, so, you know, basically the scenario really quick was, we were camped in a spike camp, like up on a ridge and the thermals just weren't working well for us to hunt downhill. You know, because the thermals are going down first thing in the morning. So we're like, hey, we know there's some wallows down below us, not too far. Let's just split up and hopefully we'll catch them like contouring to these wallows. So basically we're just kind of moving into an area that we knew they would basically sift towards these wallows. So we split up, we set up. I was like, hey, three bugles, move back to camp. Like that was like literally like we made that decision right there. We're going to split up. I'm like, three bugles, move back to camp. He was like, cool. So we split up and then, I mean, it was maybe 45 minutes or an hour. And, I hear five bugles. I'm like, I don't know what that means. and so I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay,
that means
so
go back to camp and make dinner.
I don't know. So I'm sitting there. I'm like, well, what do I do? And so I bugled three back to him and I kind of hung out and I was like, okay. I was like, well, I guess I'll go back to camp. So I hiked back up, and because I just wasn't unsure. We'd already gotten separated once before, with kind of like this flip-flop around, like waiting for a packer to come get meat, and he was with another partner, and we almost missed each other, and it was just kind of like this, like, we just didn't know where each other were at. So I go back to camp, and I'm like, okay, cool. And so I pop out my little Lord of the Rings book, and I'm just kind of reading in camp, just kind of waiting for him to come back up. And like an hour later, like, he shows up just like sweating, and he has like a whole quarter sticking out the back of his pack. I'm like, oh, I jump up. I'm like, oh my God, you got one? He goes, yeah, I got one. Where have you been? You know, I had the kill kit in my bag. And so he was super frustrated because he didn't, you know, basically started breaking down this elk with just a tiny little knife, because I had like the nice knives in our kill kit. And he was just like, just very annoyed at me. But we didn't have a, you know, I'm just sitting there reading in like the dapples, enjoying a beautiful day. And, you know, he's down there, you know, hacking on this bull. And so it was like, okay, like we need to come up with another system. And the interesting thing we learned was he actually had like a police style whistle. Because he blew it, and then he was waiting and waiting, and then he didn't come. So then he just started blowing on the safety whistle. I didn't hear the safety whistle once, like not at all. And he's like, you didn't hear my whistle? I go, no. You know, and I'm sitting like in the timber in like a very like isolated camp, just sitting there reading. I wasn't like messing with stuff or cooking, you know, and didn't hear the whistle at all until I think one time he was probably like 40 yards away and he blew that whistle, or 50 yards. And then I obviously heard it, and I kind of stood up and looked. But so we realized that like this, even those safety sounds that everyone carries in the woods, like, they don't seem to carry very well, but the bugle seemed to really carry well, especially when done repetitively, like back to back. Cause then once again, you can really clearly separate, like, is that a bull like throwing out a locator? Or is that my partner talking to me? So we do the multiple ones, like boom, boom, boom. And so we kind of have created our own little system, very similar to the Mew system that uses locator bugles.
Yeah, so two means this, three means that, four means that, and just come up with an own system for that.
Yeah, yeah, and come up with whatever makes sense to you. I mean, obviously one's not going to work because you're not going to know if it's a real bull thrown out a locator or just your hunting partner.
Yeah.
But when you start doing those multiple ones and they're like near images of each other, it's mm-hmm. pretty easy to identify that, hey, my partner's trying to communicate with me.
Yeah, I think if they have the same tone, the same cadence, and a back-to-back, it's gonna be pretty dang obvious.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely.
So that's one of the things, nonverbal communication. You covered hand signals, you know, kind of talking through the calling setups with the Hoochie Mamas, and then this long distance communication with the bugles. That's awesome. So one of the other things, and you just mentioned it, one of the lessons you learned just in general is that sound doesn't travel as far as you think, especially when you're hunting those timbered areas. So not only the safety whistle example, but how does that affect, for example, the hunting scenario? So you guys, say you're together, you hear an actual bull. How does that play out in terms of mm-hmm. what you've learned with sound not traveling as far as you think?
Yeah, because our daily routine seems to be like we have an area that we want to hunt. And so we come up with a plan. And it's like, hey, we're going to move up here. You know, the thermals are going to switch around this time. So then we'll change directions and move here. And we know there's certain spots A, B, and C. So we always move into the day with like a pretty proactive plan. But then as soon as you hear a bugle, everything changes, right? So it's kind of like you're planning for not seeing anything. But then when you see or hear something, then the plans will change. And so anytime we hear a bugle, then we basically make a decision on like, okay, hey, well, it goes Wyatt, my hunting partner, he'll tell me how far he thinks it is and what direction. And then I'll say how far I think it is and what direction. And typically they're a little bit different, you know, like I'll say 200, he'll say 400. I'll say north and he'll say northeast. And so what we do is we kind of just meet right in the middle, you know? So if he's pointing one way and I'm pointing the other, then we're going to go right in the middle of those two points. But one thing we saw over time after time was we always got on the animals much sooner than expected. So it got to the point where I would just take my initial guess and I would just chop it in half. And then it started getting closer and closer. So I think this is totally going to be dependent, I think, on like how dense the timber is. I don't think the same rules would apply if you're like in Arizona and those kind of rolling hills with like the sage and, you know, the juniper. But in timber, it does not seem to carry very far. And also one of the reasons that we kind of enjoy sifting through those that heavy timber whenever they aren't being very vocal is that sometimes being in close proximity seems to like make them vocal. So we may bugle from a trail or up on a ridgeline, not get a response, but then we just dive into the timber and we're moving. And then all of a sudden we throw a locator bugle out maybe 200 yards from a bull, then he'll respond. And so it seems that proximity kind of seems to help as well.
Yeah. Man, that's been my experience exactly as well. It's so key to, it's tough, man, especially when you're new, right? You hear a bugle and you're like, is that 50 yards? Is that 250 yards? I mean, that can be tough to figure out for sure. And still to this day, like there's times that I feel like I'm tricked by it, right? Like whether that's the sound funneling through terrain a funny way or just, you know, you get into a windier condition and it can be deceiving. But yeah, I think in general, the rule that you have is just kind of assume almost like the thing in the mirror. It's closer than it appears.
Well, it's real. It's at least when I first started, I would get really excited, you know, like, oh, you know, I get all pumped up. And then so like my initial approach would be a lot more aggressive than it is now. I'd kind of like start stomping through the woods like very quickly. Cause I'm like, oh, he's like 400 yards away. And so, you know, here I go just tearing through the woods. And then, you know, 200 yards in, it's like, oh, you know, I just got to freeze and he's just looking right at me. And so, I think having that patience and being like, hey, you know, he's not, you know, either he's going to be there when I get there or he's not, you know, there's not too much you can control.
So another lesson, learned the hard way and over your experiences, hunt all day. How does that play out for you?
I think it comes back to at first I was like a camp guy. Like the first couple of years I did it, like I would love to go back to camp during the day and just kind of hang out, you know, if I was hunting near a truck, which I don't do at all anymore. But, one of the years I did, now I'd go back and make like a breakfast cause I had a cooler in the truck and stuff. And it was pretty nice. But, my hunting partner, really shied me away from that. He was like, why are you going to spend all this time training and shooting your bow and getting all this expensive equipment and then driving, you know, anywhere from 12 to 18 hours, to go hunt for 2 or 3 hours and then go back to your truck and hang out. And I was like, that's a good point, you know? And so, typically we go back to camp for comfort and it is nice to have that, you know, hot cup of coffee at 10 a.m. But really, I mean, if you think about like the intention and the purpose of going out there, it's like, hey, we kind of want to put ourselves in a different environment and like be in the woods. And so we decided that like, hey, to get the most opportunities possible, like we're just going to hunt the entire day. And so when we go out, you know, leaving camp at, you know, 5:30 a.m., whatever time it may be, we're out and we don't come back until after dark, unless we have a planned rest day where we're doing laundry and kind of camp chores because we're out there so long. But you just in the middle of the day, even if you're going to like, hey, I want to take an hour long nap. I've laid down and, you know, took a nap and then all of a sudden I hear something and I would think of like, is my partner calling right now? And I kind of look at him and he's like sitting up like very still and a group of elk would just walk right by us. So, I mean, anyone who hunts knows that luck is it's a pretty big component in hunting, you know, just kind of being in the right place at the right time. So instead of going back to camp and just hanging out, if you decide you need to take a rest, just take a rest out, like, you know, in the heavy timber in a nice little glade or, you know, laying against a log in the dapples and just rest right there. You know, if you're eating your food, be really quiet. If you have a hunting partner there, whisper and just spend the entire day out there. So we've, you know, seen so many animals and had so many opportunities right in the middle of the day on a really, really warm, hot day during archery season that we wouldn't have gotten if we went back to camp.
Yeah, for sure. So that leads to the next lesson you mentioned, always be ready for a shot. And by always, you mean always, and by ready, you mean fully ready. So describe that.
It's happened to me like 3 or 4 times now, Mark. it's so embarrassing when you're sitting there like, okay, it's like 7 days in. And you know what? It's like, I'm going to shoot the first legal animal I see. Like, because at a certain point, especially with multiple guys, like, man, like, you know, tagging out the whole team, or especially if it's more than two guys, like that's challenging on public land. So, but like, we'll just, you know, sit down, hang out, like let's have, you know, pull out my trail mix and make a little Gatorade drink or whatever. And you're just sitting there relaxing. And like 20 minutes later, like, you know, 3 or 4 elk would just walk up at like 20 yards and kind of stop and just kind of like look at you. And then you're just like, oh, are you serious? You know, like you've been hunting 3 or 4 hard days and haven't seen or had an opportunity, and then you get caught with your pants down. So not only for like if you're resting, but I mean, it happened last year with my collar. You know, we got on a bull really fast, and it had a really fast setup, and he managed to walk right by me within range. I mean, it was just like the one window he had. I wasn't at full draw yet. And so he passed it. So I didn't have a clear shot. And he walked like right up to my partner, who was just like hiding behind a tree, and just looked up. And then there was like, you know, a bull standing there looking at him. And so now our rule of thumb is like, no matter what, if we stop, and when I say stop, I mean, I don't mean like stop and like mess with your pack. But if we stop and like sit down for a couple of minutes, it's like, we're going to knock an arrow. You're going to set your bow up in a place that you can reach it easily, whether that's on a kickstand or a log or a pack. And just always be ready, because those shots, they just present themselves so quickly. And I mean, like last year, I remember like I felt like a little ninja in the woods. Like I saw these elk, they were right there, and my bow was like just out of reach. So I'm moving like so slow, you know, because I'm within eyesight of the animals very clearly. And I was just like reaching. I got all the way to the point where I was able to sit up, and right before I drew, they bolted. So if that bow would have been like right there in my lap, I probably could have taken that shot and had an animal earlier. So always be ready.
Yeah, man, it's so true. I have so many examples of that as well. I mean, there was one year we joked because we sat down. It must have been like three different times throughout the single day to try and have a snack. And every time we would sit down, either we would hear something move super close to us because we were in the timber, or, you know, a bull would fire off and we'd get into him like within seconds, you know?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
It was just like, apparently we're not supposed to eat today. and then there was other times where for sure, I mean, you know, I've been the caller, and you know, I'm working a bull that I think is, you know, on the other side of me and my partner, but then here comes another elk and maybe comes in completely silent on my backside. So I've literally gone from collar to full draw on a bull that was, you know, maybe 15 yards away before you even know what's going on. So, man, that's so important, because opportunities they can be hard to come by, and sometimes they come when you least expect it. And then if you miss that opportunity, dang, that hurts.
Yeah, and it's not like you have to do something extraordinary. You're just simply gonna knock an arrow, or I guess for a rifle, you're just gonna kind of keep it in a position where you can access it. So. Honestly, just kind of, if you don't do it, and after once or twice, and if you're just kind of being lazy at that point, it's like, man, I could have just killed an animal. It's like, okay, well, what do I got to do differently? It's like, just, you know, have my weapon within reach. And if it's a bow, just knock that arrow. And then, yeah, you got to take the arrow off. And yeah, you might dull your broadhead sticking it back in the quiver every time. But, I think you'll still get the job done, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So another one of the lessons, and this is one of those, well, duh, that's stupid and simple, and we all know that, but it's one of, because it's so common advice, it's actually easy to let it go, is to always carry essential gear. Again, by always, you mean always. How did that play out for you?
Yeah, that was at the same, that was right after that bull that my buddy had shot when I was at camp reading the book, right? And so he, at this point, he doesn't think he's as tough as he is, but he's pretty damn tough. And so we get up to the top, and at this point, you know, he's kind of frustrated at me, but even though it more frustrated the situation, because, you know, that was not a predetermined like course of action here in Five Bugles, was to come to him. So I go, what are you taking down? Because the bull was probably only like, it was probably about a 30-minute walk downhill from camp. It wasn't that far. And he goes, I'm not taking anything, just my frame. And I was like, okay, because at this point now it's, you know, a warm morning in New Mexico, and it's bluebird day, beautiful. And so, hey, we got to go. We got to like break this thing down so it can get cool. So like, all right, sweet. Sounds good. So I grabbed my pack, and that was it. Like no water, no food, like pack, kill kit. That was it. And so we get down there, and we've had like bluebird weather for like 7 days. And we've been carrying like not only jackets, but like rain pants as well. And so 7 days of carrying rain gear. And we get down this bull and we start working on it, and like a hailstorm comes in, like a full hailstorm. And I just started like laughing and just kind of shaking my head. I go, what are the chances? Like really, we just like 30 minutes ago dropped our rain gear at camp, and we decided to come downhill and knock this out real fast. And it's never really fast. I mean, it's gonna take a couple hours to break down a bull. So we get down there, and at that point too, like we're already, I mean, it's probably 10 or 11 a.m. at this point, and like my partner hasn't eaten. He's probably dehydrated. And then we started getting like wet, and we didn't even have long sleeve shirts. We just had like these kind of like wool blend short sleeve shirts like Kuyu and First Light Mix. And it just starts dumping. So we try to hide underneath a spruce, and it doesn't really help. We ended up getting a trash bag, cutting it in half, kind of making like a little poncho just to kind of keep us dry. And it was just kept going and going. And at one point, it got to a point where like my partner was starting to shiver. And like I said, he didn't say anything, but I could just tell. I'm like, okay, now we're starting to dance that fine line. But we ended up getting it done. And the worst part of the story was, Mark, that whenever I went into my pack to put the meat into it, I found my rain jacket. My rain jacket was in the bottom of the pack. So I pulled out my rain pants, but I didn't pull out my jacket. And so at this point, we're both like, you know, thoroughly soaked. But, you know, luckily camp wasn't a base camp wasn't that far away, and the sun came back out and we dried. But yeah, I think it's really important to like not get lazy and be like, hey, if this is required equipment, which I would say at least a rain jacket is required equipment in the mountains, because if you get wet, things can go south pretty quick. And other things, whether it's, you know, a kill kit, a spot, an in-reach, if you need something, like keep it with you at all times, because it's that whole, you know, two is one is none kind of thing comes into play, where it's like you're going to need it when you don't have it. And if you leave it behind, it's, you know, you're going to find yourselves in a pickle.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a photo of that exact moment at the article, which is great, of you in the short sleeve t-shirt holding the piece of a trash bag over your head, and you can literally see piles of hail on the ground.
Yeah, it was just one of those, because it started raining. I go, oh, great. And luckily, I mean, the hail kind of helped because like it'll hit you and bounce off, right, versus just getting you wet. And so we had a good dose of the hail through the middle that was kind of bracketed by rain. And the rain was what got us. The hail was kind of more just like, I just looked at him and just shook my head. I go, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, like, it's just a nuisance.
Like, what are the chances, you know? And so like our, you know, meat tarp, you know, like all the hail fell on it. And then like, then it started melting. So we were having to mess with the wet meat, you know, and it was just everything about the process was against how we wanted it to happen. You know, like your goal is to get the meat dry and tacky and then get it in the bag. And it's just getting soaked through this rain and hail. And, you know, then it kind of buckles and the little pine needles wash in. So then you got to pick the pine needles off the meat. And yeah, it was just kind of like, it was one of those, I have a video of it actually. I'm just laughing. And at that point, like I said, we hadn't eaten. We didn't bring water down with us. We were wet. We were cold. And it was just, I'm like, wow, how did we get ourselves in this situation? We know better than this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially with, you know, taking even a relatively short trip to, as you mentioned, quote unquote, quickly break down a bowl, right? Like that always turns into a process that's at least a couple hours, you know?
Yeah. There's nothing quick about that unless you got like a forklift and
right.
And like three guys who are really good with big knives. I mean, it takes a while, especially if you're going to do it right. You
exactly.
know, if you're just going to like hack the quarters off with the hide still on and it's the middle of winter, that's one thing. But if you're like archery season and you're going to get like all the meat,
yep.
It takes a while.
Yeah. So one of the lessons was get meat in the bag as soon as possible, because you had some experience where you thought kind of things were good, but then you got back later and kind of had some issues or close to having some serious issues with some of the meat. How did that work for you?
Yeah. So we had three bulls that we shot this year. So one went out pretty early. The guy ended up, he basically took his bull out. And then he went to Colorado to try to hunt a second elk. And so me and my partner stayed in, and his bull got taken out. And then my bull was the final one that we shot, and everything was perfect. I've been on elk and other animals that like when you start quartering them, that there's just flies everywhere. Like, it's like, you know, they're just bzzz. And this was not the situation this year at all. Where it was like a nice day and it was perfect out. And so we started breaking it down. I mean, everything was super clean. Like, we did a good job breaking this animal down. And you know, so we'll pull off the meat, whether it's the neck, the brisket, a quarter, whatever it may be, and we'll let it just kind of get dry. And we use a piece of Tyvek is what we use, because trash bags seem to not let things dry. It's kind of like wet on plastic and it stays. So we just get like a small square of Tyvek, which I think is actually used in home construction. And it works really good because it's kind of porous. And so it allows the meat to still kind of get dry on the bottom side. So we just let it get tacky, and then we'll toss it in the bags. And, you know, then the work begins to get it somewhere where either you're going to pack it out on a trail or you're going to get horses in there. And so we were moving pretty good, enjoying ourselves. Like the hunt was over at that point. Everyone was successful. We get the meat out in the bags, hung. Took it to a meat locker overnight. So, I mean, this was, I'm saying, we got it from the time I shot it to the meat locker. And this is a commercial meat locker. We got it there, I think, in just over 24 hours. It was the next day that evening. And so that was breaking down a camp. That was a 7-mile hike out. Horses took the meat out, you know, getting everything loaded up, driving 2 hours to the nearest place that, you know, had a locker, got it in there before they closed and let it sit overnight. So it was not a long period of time. Get dry ice on it the next day, get to Texas. And then I think it was the day after that, we were like, hey, well, let's just butcher this ourselves, because we really like to butcher our own meat because we can cut it the way we want it. We can grind it the kind of the grind that we want. We can trim it ahead of time the way we want to. And so me, my girlfriend, my buddy and his wife and his daughter, like five of us in this air conditioned garage, we start, you know, going to town on this bull and we pull it out and I'm like, what is this? And I'm just kind of looking at it. It's little tiny looking like grains is what it looked like. And so of course our girlfriend and wife are there. And so we look at each other and we start whispering and, cause we don't want them to see it.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you think this is? He goes, I have no clue. And at first we thought that maybe it was just like kind of like the little pollen or grain seeds that are on that tall grass that you see out in the meadows.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in a burn when we shot this, and so there was no grass. And I was like, man, I don't remember those being on there. And so we kind of talked about it, and then, you know, I was like, I'm just going to look online. And so I did a quick Google search, and I typed in fly eggs, and then sure enough, the image popped up. And so, I mean, they're super small. I mean, like take a rice kernel and maybe cut it into 7 or 8 pieces. And that was how small it is. But it was just like little clusters in different spots. And it was always on the exposed portion of the meat. So then I Google, of course, like, well, is this bad to eat? So because I don't want to like be digesting, you know, larva. And it's basically that what I found from reading online was like, hey, it's organic matter. It's fine. But so we did our very best to clean as much of it off as possible. And then the rest of it, the grinder took care of, and the girls were actually fine with it. Surprisingly, they're like, okay, just get as much as you can off, you know? And so we learned like, you know, normally we like to like let it get dry and then we toss it in the bags. Cause I mean, anyone who's carried down animal knows that if you put the bloody meat in your bag, then blood gets everywhere. And if you're using a trash bag, then it's like hot, wet and moist inside there. And so we just kind of like to have it a little on the drier side whenever we pack it out and hang it. And so now our new rule is just like, hey, like soon as that meat comes out, like right in the bag, get it sealed, keep it away from anything that can contaminate it or expose it to agents.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said for letting it dry out and kind of get that crust, or as you said, tack up, like in the right conditions. If you can do it, great. But unfortunately, like especially in those early archery seasons, you don't necessarily have that luxury.
Yeah, and it seemed like there were more yellow jackets than there were bees. Not bees, but more flies. Like, yep. So, I mean, I've been on a couple animals where you're just like, oh my, like this is insane, you know? And so you're trying to sprinkle pepper everywhere, and there's just like this horde of flies, and you just can't do anything about it. But like this one, it was really strange because like barely saw any flies. It was breezy. We were up on kind of like this big burn, so like nothing was stopping the wind, and it's still like they got us somehow. I'm not sure. And we also like zip tie our game bag, so it wasn't like they were sneaking through the cracks in the game bag where like, you know, the quarter was sticking out. So yeah, that was, and like I said, that was, I mean, between us, how many deer, elk and feral hogs we've shot, I mean, a lot, and never seen anything like that, especially with the time frame and the considerations that we took. It was real surprising.
Yeah. So just a couple more. One related to getting meat out again is just to have a pack out plan and stick to it. And I think this is one of those ones that's worth thinking about ahead of time, coming up with a plan ahead of time, because when you get in that moment of like getting something down, especially something really big like an elk, like sometimes you're just not thinking straight. Sometimes you make stupid decisions. Speaking from experience on how you should pack that thing out. So
yes, we've all done that.
Yeah. So you guys have, you know, thought about it ahead of time and made some decisions. Help us think through that and what decisions, you know, have you guys made in terms of, all right, here's the plan if this happens.
Yeah. Well, now mind you, Mark, that decision was not in place last season because we just got, I mean, so crushed. It was, and now I want to, I kind of want to make clear that, you know, it really does depend on where the animal goes down at.
For sure.
So when it comes to like hiking on a trail, I mean, most Forest Service trails, you can load a pack up as heavy as you want. And it's not going to be dangerous. It's just going to be hard and take you a long time. And so, you know, hear stories with the guys, like I can pack out a whole cow on one trip or whatever, crazy internet thing stories. It's like, cool. Like if you want to load your pack and it can handle 200 pounds and you're going to walk out 5 or 6 miles on a trail, go for it, right? But when you're in the heavy timber, that's not the time, because what we're concerned about is incurring an injury, right? Whether that can be like a lower extremity injury, an ankle, a knee, something like that. It could be a puncture wound. Anyone who's ever crawled through like really heavy timber knows that, I mean, it's hard to move through timber just with your bow and a small pack. To think you can do that safely with 100+ pounds is just foolish. And like me and my partner, I would say we're both very fit. You know, we've done that train to hunt challenge, you know, like back when they had the heavy packs, and it was like, cool, we're going to race at 90 pounds for like 1.5 miles and run the entire time. So we've carried plenty of heavy packs before. And this one trip, basically, and this is another thing that kind of ties into that, was, so we'd shot a bull and it was a really big bull. His antlers actually looked small because his body was so big, because it was a 6x6. And I walked up like, oh, that's kind of a small set of antlers. And then we realized his body was just so big that it made the antlers look small. Cause once the head came off, it was beautiful. It was like, oh, that doesn't look small at all. And so we heard other bugles. So one of the mistakes we made was, instead of focusing on the animal we had down and getting that immediately hung somewhere that was, secure and ready to be extracted, we wanted to go hunt more. So we broke it down. We got it hung pretty much in the immediate vicinity, and then we went and hunted. And I was like, hey, like we should definitely get back in time to do this in the daylight. And of course we didn't, you know, we got back like right before dark, getting all the packs loaded up. And my partner was like, he's like, I want to try to carry it in one trip. I go, this is not a good idea. So, and one of the guys, he was 57. So he's an older guy. But he was still a stud. He did really well. And he kind of looked at me. So we ended up, you know, going out. I was like, hey, we should follow our tracks that we took in, because hiking in to move on this bull was actually like a really smooth, easy path. But we knew where we were at. We knew where the trail was. And we're like, no, let's just go as the bird flies, you know, straight south. We'll hit the trail. And man, we got caught in, I think in the article I referred to it as murkwood, is what we call it, where it's just like so heavy and so thick that like when you get stuck in it, even just hunting, not even with a pack, you're like, dude, what are we doing? There's no way we're going to shoot an animal in here. Like any animal within 100 yards knows we are here, you know, cause it's like crack, crack, crashing through the woods. So we ended up getting stuck in the dark, B, carrying way too much weight, C, we got separated, you know, so if one of us did get injured, we got at a certain point where we couldn't even communicate with one another. One of the guys fell, you know, he bent the pin on his bow. Finally, we made the decision. I was like, hey, this is foolish. There's no reason to try to get this all out in one trip, especially in the dark. And so we ended up dropping some of the meat. And then even with what we had, was still over 100 pounds at that point, getting down, finally getting it hung. We bumped into our third partner. He was worried sick. He was like, where have you guys been? You know, because he managed to find another way out that was faster. And so he beat us to camp. And so it just ended up being one of those nights where it was just like this is so stupid. Like we could have avoided this if we had a plan, not try to like man up and make it this crazy challenge. Because at that point, we still had two more bulls to hunt. So if one of us would have gotten hurt, our hunt could have been over. And so I think there's a lot of kind of pride in like how much weight you can load up and this and that. But I think the important thing is like I said, we're fit, strong guys. You know, I own a gym. My partner's a total stud. If you go back there with less fitness, or if you're not training regularly, then it can really be a recipe for disaster. So we came up with, now it's like considerations are light, the terrain you're carrying it in, whether it's uphill, whether it's downhill. So now we have like a set kind of protocol that like next year, like we won't change it. Not like, doesn't matter how much adrenaline you got going and how excited you are. It's like, hey, like this is our plan. We came up with this for a reason and we're going to stick with it. Cause one of the guys that was with me, like I didn't know if it was just me being a total, you know, BITCH, or if it was really as bad as I expected, right? So you kind of, you're like, man, am I just being weak or is this like stupid? Mm-hmm. And the guy I was with, you know, two of us got separated. Like we got down and finally just dropped the pack. And he just kind of sat down. It was just like worst pack out ever. And like, and this guy is, he's experienced. Like I said, I think it was his 10th or 11th bull he shot this year, like nice mature bulls. He's been hunting a long time. He's kind of like my partner's mentor. And he's, I mean, he's very popular on the forums and stuff. And when he said that, I was like, yes, it's not just me. Yeah. You know? Cause I thought it was like, man, I'm having like a moment right here.
Right.
What am I doing? Like, I should be fitter than this. I should be stronger than this. And I was just getting crushed. And, I mean, just like you would see one piece of deadfall that was like 4 feet off the ground. And I'm only 5'7", and you're just sitting there, you're like, and you're totally trapped in by other, you know, pieces of deadfall. And you're like, how am I going to get over this? So, yeah, I think it's be smart out there. It's not the place to, you know, test your manhood when there's a chance of injury.
Man, that's so key. Yeah. So you guys made some good rules of like, if the location's uphill from the kill site, we'll do this. If it's downhill, we'll do that. Mm-hmm. If it's heavily timbered, we'll do this. If the sunset, we'll do that. So think through all those things, guys, and make some decisions accordingly. I mean, the other thing, which you mentioned it, but can be so key as well, is if you know a way out, often what you're familiar with is what's best versus trying to get clever.
You know,
like the first bull my buddy and I packed out years ago, we knew a way to get back to the trail, but then we made the stupid decision of looking at the map and going, oh, we can make it shorter by getting to the trail this way.
Yeah.
And there was like, it was like, okay, so the trail was above us by a fair amount, but like if we make a straight line here, we'll, you know, hit the trail up on the ridge, but we'll come up through a saddle so it won't be too bad and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the topo lines don't look bad. Well, guess what? Topo lines lie. I mean, it was to the point where it was like, as soon as I was putting hands on the ground to stabilize myself and I had, half of a bull on my back, I was like, this was retarded. You know, we should have absolutely gone back the way we knew, versus trying to get clever and coming up with, well, the map says this, let's give it a shot. Like, let's give it a shot isn't the right thing to say when, you know, you have half a bull on your back.
Yeah, I think it's, take the moment and, like, think about what you're doing. Because at that point, you know, we'd loaded up and like, we could barely even stand up straight. I go, this is so stupid. And then, like, I was like, should we just go down the same tracks we came up? Because my partner had a GPS running, so we could, like, mirrored our steps. And I don't know who it was, and it might have been me, I don't know, but one of us suggested, like, let's just go straight south. And I was just kind of like, okay. And so we went, and it was, I mean, we totally got caught, like, in just this monster pit where, I mean, at one point, we were just looking around, like, I don't even know what to do right now. Should I just drop everything and come back tomorrow? You know? I mean, because when it gets dark, you can't pick your path, you know, like, in the daytime, you can, you know, usually see and kind of sift these, like 50 to 70 yard lanes, more or less, like you can kind of see, but with just a regular, like, you know, small headlamp, you can only see, you know, 15 or 20 yards in front of you. So you're like, oh, that looks clear. And then you just walk yourself into a pocket, you know, so you can't make those kind of like long-term, long distance decisions in the dark. And so, yeah, it crushed us. I mean, we were, there wasn't a lot of chit chat when we got back to the camp that night.
Yeah. So let's wrap up with the last one. This is a good one to conclude with. Again, something super simple, but that's easy to get caught up on. And that is, don't expect elk to do something because they did it before. You know, it makes me think of, I think it's the Einstein quote of, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Like, that's the definition of stupidity, right? So how does that work specific scenarios with you, for example, with elk that you've experienced?
It's funny because my hunting partner, like he is the definition of an elk hunter. Like, any free moment he has, like, he is on Google Earth. He is reading an article. He's, you know, looking at a podcast. Like, he is like a walking elk, like, dictionary or like encyclopedia when I'm with him. And so it was multiple times the past couple of years we've hunted is like an animal would do something. And it was like, huh. It's like, I've never heard of an animal doing that, you know? And so everything from like their behavior, like when they herd up, the time of the year and like the moon cycles, like you try to kind of like predict like, oh, this would be a great time to go hunt. You know, it's this window of time, the moon's doing this, the weather's been doing this, or it's a dry year or wet year. You kind of come up with this plan on trying to like ID the best time to go and the best scenarios. But I mean, a couple of times, like I think two of the ones I mentioned in the article were just like hunted the same area multiple years back to back. And then, you know, this year, I think it was when I shot my bull on the 12th or 13th. So like it was in New Mexico. So we're getting right on the change of first archery and second archery. And you know, we were calling in these bulls and they were still in like a bachelor group. Like there was no cows with them. It was like we saw, I think, four or five bulls, one of which I'd called in right after I'd shot mine. And it was like, why are they still in this group? You know, because previously, I mean, I'd been the same unit 2 years prior and my partner had been there 3 years prior. It was, they were already herded up, like, you know, fourth day of the season. They're already in groups. And granted, it wasn't like the full rut where, you know, the big herd bulls like running around going crazy. But they already were in herds. And this is really strange to see that. Seeing them just do daily behavior that you don't expect, you know, finding them feeding in a sunny, warm area in the middle of the day. It's just kind of like, huh, you know, you always read, oh, they go to a north facing slope and bed down for the day. And it was like, this is not what I've read. Like, you know, they are standing there in a warm, sunny meadow, you know, feeding. Like that's strange. We had an animal run, one of the bulls that we shot, you know, we were sitting there looking and like, oh, he probably ran down there. And I mean, this bull ran like straight uphill. And I mean, he was like so severely wounded. The blood trail was so thick. You could have like just followed it by closing your eyes and putting your hands on the ground. I mean, it was just like a fire hose. So I think, whenever you read articles and you hear things from guys on podcasts, you know, it's probably important and it's probably is going to happen like the vast majority of the time. But you got to also think that they're not always going to do what you think they're going to do. And their behavior is not always going to be consistent. So you kind of have to kind of plan on that. Don't have these like concrete ideas in your mind that like if A happens, then B will be the result. Always be ready for that kind of different scenario that could pop up.
Yeah. I mean, I think the common wisdom stuff is good to kind of plan on and to consider for sure. But at the same time, if it's not working, don't be afraid to think out of the box because, oh, that's not what they're supposed to do or that's not what I'm supposed to do. I mean, man, the exact scenario you talked about of like an elk being out in a warm area and in the sun feeding, I've run into that. That's, you know, where I killed a bull in 2016. It was like last day of the hunt. What's the one thing we haven't done? What's the one place to go that doesn't make sense? And sure enough, we end up killing an elk there. So sometimes it's that, you know, if it's when you've tried everything else and it's not working just because it isn't what they're supposed to do, don't be afraid to try it, you know? So yeah, that's so key. It's so easy to think inside the box, if you will.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was funny because, my partner would always tell me like, you know, like practice shooting on your knees before you go hunt, because like, you know, if you're a shooter, you're going to get on your knees, lower your profile, et cetera, et cetera. It's like every animal I've shot with my bow or every elk I've shot, I've been standing, you know? And so it's kind of one of those things where it's like, you got to kind of take what others say and their experience and then your personal experience as well. But like for me on my knees, my shooting lanes were greatly reduced because of like timber and vegetation on the ground. Also, I couldn't move when I was on my knees. Like if I try to like do a half turn to the right, if I shuffle my knees, my feet are on the ground, my shins, my knees, it makes all this noise. When if I'm standing, I can just do like a slight step and then be able to draw and take a shot. So I think always don't be afraid to think out of the box, kind of like what you just said, Mark.
Cool. That's awesome. Man, there's so much good stuff in here. Jake, thanks for taking the time not only put the article together for us, which listeners, you guys can go find at the XO Mountain Gear site. If you just search for elk hunting lessons, the article is titled Eight Elk Hunting Lessons Learned the Hard Way. But yeah, thanks for joining us for the podcast as well.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Super flattering because I just think I'm an average level hunter, but hopefully some guys can take some key bits away.
Well, as always, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget, if you want to share a review, we would certainly appreciate it. It does help us tremendously. If you have any questions or anything else we can help with, be sure just to shoot us an email. It's a podcast at exomountgear.com. And if you're listening to this show as it comes out in August of 2018, go check out the In My Exo giveaway. A ton of great prizes up for grabs, simple to enter. Go check that out at exomountaingear.com/InMyExo.